Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It is Thursday, July the 9th, 2020. I'm the host here, Ed Harrison. I'm going to be talking to my great colleague, Tyler Neville, for the first time here on the Real Vision Daily Briefing. But first, let's go to Peter Cooper with the stories of the day.
Thanks, Ed. 1.31 million is this week's new job loss claims number in the U.S., slightly lower than the projected 1.38 million. Continuing claims also receded more than expected, but still remain above 18 million. In the U.S., the jobs picture continues to look bleak. And the story of unemployment is also seen through the veil of other headlines. Bed Bath & Beyond will be closing 20% of their stores in the next 2 years, while United Airlines informed nearly half of their workforce that they could be furloughed on October 1st. The government loans to airlines contain provisions that protected airline workers until September 30th. But United clearly isn't seeking to protect their workers beyond what is mandated. And with Brooks Brothers declaring bankruptcy yesterday, we're witnessing how job losses and insolvency are intertwined. But America is not the only country encountering mass unemployment. Europe is facing it as well. German airline Lufthansa announced on Tuesday plans to cut 20% of its leadership positions, as well as 1,000 administrative positions. Lufthansa Group employs about 138,000 people. The airline also said that they had 22,000 staff positions that they no longer needed, but they would seek to avoid laying off those people. Aerospace juggernaut Airbus is set to cut 15,000 jobs, 11% of its workforce, as their orders have plummeted. The unionized workforce fiercely resisted these mass layoffs, and they staged a walkout protest. In Britain, things are not much better. A chief executive at Burger King warned they might have to cut 1,600 jobs in the UK alone. Pharmacy chain Boots announced 4,000 layoffs, and Rolls-Royce just announced it would let go of over 9,000 employees. While we can see the immediate impact of unemployment caused by the pandemic, the long-term effect could crystallize how certain industries were already anticipating job shrinkage prior to the coronavirus. For example, in Germany, the National Platform Future for Mobility, a research agency backed by the German government, had released a report in January saying that by 2030, more than 400,000 jobs in the car industry will be gone. That's almost half of the 830,000 jobs that exist in the German car industry as of last year. This prediction comes in tandem with the rise of electric cars. Not as many workers are required to build electric cars, and there are the high costs and difficulties in retraining workers. Ferdinand Dodenhofer, director of the Center for Automatic Research, had said that the more realistic number would be 250,000 jobs lost in the next 10 years, 150,000 due to the switch to electromobility, and 100,000 due to the pandemic. In Germany, some of those job losses may look like not replacing workers when others retire or leave. Regardless of the actual number or how the job losses occur, we need to consider the long-term effects that the pandemic could have on employment, not just in the here and now. We know that the bumpy road to reopening plays a critical factor in these elevated levels of unemployment. And we also know that there has been permanent job destruction in the global economy. And we might be tempted to believe that this is US specific. However, we're still seeing these residual effects of the lockdown in countries that appear to have the virus under control, demonstrating how this recession will be drawn out and difficult to recuperate from. And with that, let's go over to Ed and Tyler.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Thanks, Peter. So, Tyler, it is great to talk to you. That was an interesting intro and, you know, good intro into you. I want to talk to you today about the other side of this whole jobs thing. I would call it a terrible economy. And you're someone who knows about the financial economy, that is hedge funds, flows, the buy side. Tell people a little bit about yourself before you went to Real Vision.
Thanks, Ed. So my background basically has been I was on the sell side for a year and then probably about a decade on the buy side. I spent time at hedge funds, a giant mutual fund, and pretty much traded equities and derivatives that whole time. So,
right. So, you know, a lot about, you know, what's happening on the street, how much flows dominate liquidity, and what that means in terms of supply and demand and buoyancy in markets. Because to me, there's a huge disconnect between the stories that Peter was talking about in terms of job losses here in the U.S. and also elsewhere, and the buoyancy that you see in markets right now. And you and I, before we got on, we were talking about this yesterday. You were telling me about what you're seeing. And, you know, from what I heard from what you were talking about, it seems like you're seeing a lot of inflows, a lot of flows that support more bullishness in the market.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the U.S. fiscal spending is now 35% of GDP, which is astronomical, like $7 trillion, right? But what I find most fascinating, and this is what no one talks about in the market, I think it's the biggest disconnect in the entire public market space, which is portfolio managers don't understand liquidity that well, and traders can't articulate it. And so what's happening on the microstructure part of things is really, really interesting. So with this new emergence of the retail trader at like E-Trade, Schwab, Robinhood, essentially how that market functions is all those trades are now commission free, right? You have no hurdle rate to the market anymore. So what happens is they go and say buy Tesla, right? So they package up that flow and they sell it to like a internal wholesaler, they call it. And that is now for Tesla, according to RBC, that's now 50% of the trading volume in Tesla. And what happens in internal wholesalers is you kind of remove that liquidity from the marketplace. So if you're a Fidelity or Wellington, 50% of that liquidity is now, you can't touch that, but it's getting printed to the tape. So at a giant institution, traders have this thing called TCA, trade cost analysis. And so when you're a trader and you see like volume going through and you're not catching any of that liquidity, if you have inflows, you're falling behind.
Right.
So Vanguard and, you know, BlackRock, they're basically just, they get money in and they buy. They get money in and they buy. And they're usually, I'd say, 5 to 7% of trading volume, which can move a stock a lot. So you have this retail liquidity that's printing the tape. And then you probably have money moving in from these giant institutions trying to catch up on the volume, chasing the liquidity. And it's a really illiquid tape, but you wouldn't think it because the spreads are so tight. So that's what I'm seeing on the micro side of the market.
You know, that's really interesting too, because I was looking today, I think I retweeted it, about Elon Musk. He was making fun of short sellers and so forth because his stock has popped so much. I think it's up 22% this week alone. The stock is worth, in market cap terms, more than $250 billion, which is the combined total of all the U.S. automakers, including Fiat Chrysler and Toyota Motor, combined, right? So it is really incredible. Tell me a little bit more about whether those flows, how long they can last. I mean, is it the case that this can go against all of that negative real economy data that we're seeing more recently?
God, that's a trillion-dollar question. I don't know, but there's other issues in the marketplace where I think it can go on a lot longer than we think, possibly even past the election. Because, you know, all right, take, for example, let's start on a real macro level. In 1997, there was like 7,000 public companies. Now, everyone knows this stat. You know, now it's like 3,500. So you can actually make the argument that the market's actually acting way more rational than, you know, people think. Everyone wants to short this market. They're so bearish. You know, they look around, businesses are shut down. But $7 trillion of you know, basically the Fed and fiscal spending is coming to the market, and it's going into 3,500 stocks, right? Then take away $1 trillion a year about in buybacks that remove the float, right? So you have a shrinking supply of stock, a shrinking supply of float. And if you go back to Mike Green is like the only one that talks about this, which is kind of incredible. You have, if you go back to the 2000 boom in tech stocks, what you had was a high insider holder base, which basically held the float. So only 5% of the shares outstanding were trading,
right,
which actually was a main cause of the boom in 2000. You know, and no one really concentrates on that. One of my favorite things is like, if you look at the amount of CFAs that came out of, you know, that now have CFAs, it's gone up, it's tripled in 20 years, and it's gone up 10% a year for the past 10. People love fundamental analysis because it's sexy, right? Like you get to say, you know, things like, you know, convertibles and, you know, all these fancy, you know, PE ratios and EBITDA. Yeah. The least sexy thing is analyzing, you know, the market structure. And Mike has done that incredibly well and basically said, you know, liquidity is horrible. The floats are down.
Right.
And, you know, you have not only that, but this is the biggest headwind. It's the incentives of passive versus active, which is the pricing on active funds. Like I was at a giant asset manager. It was 1% to manage, you know, a mutual fund. Every baby boomer in the country owned this fund. And what's happening is they're slowly like selling out of those mutual funds that are underperforming and reallocating to passive.
Right.
What Mike says, you know, if you're an active manager, you generally hold a 5% cash allocation. Whereas if you're passive, you hold, you know, 10 bips, which is a giant bullish thing for the market because you slowly sell and you see these, you know, pullbacks in the market, but it gets reallocated to passive. And that chart is basically just, you know, a complete, you know, diametrically opposed in terms of flows. But I think that really will stay the powerful moving force in the market till we get like a political event, which is Hong Kong dollar depeg, Saudi dollar depeg, or maybe the government comes in and says antitrust to Google, Facebook, you know, all those big things.
Right. And you know, I was looking at some of the inflows, right? Mm-hmm. ETF inflows, and I was looking, all of them are positive. In fact, the numbers that I saw said ETF inflows in 2020 are already the level that they were for the full year 2019. I'm talking, you know, LQD, this is, you know, corporate. We're talking triple Qs. You know, S&P 500 ETFs, the whole gamut, you know, it's massive inflows. So there, even in an economy where you have a double digit unemployment, you're still seeing the inflows into shares. And many of those are doing passive strategies, as you're talking about. But here's the question I have is that when you have a situation where you have these massive inflows into these mutual funds and you have market cap weighted funds, market cap weighted indices like S&P that they're going into with their passive strategies. Isn't there a need for them to therefore leg into these shares that are already being bid up by retail investors like Amazon, Netflix, Tesla, whatever it might be?
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Yeah, they're market cap weighted. So, you know, those dollars come in, they have to be allocated towards those weightings. And what else, you know, that also causes a strain on the active manager. And for fun, I was like checking out Fidelity's Contra Fund. It's like $122 billion ran by Will Danoff. But his top like 15 holdings are basically all momentum stocks. And just because he's got to keep up with all the inflows into passive, right? So it creates like these bubble herd like effects.
And, you know, so what are the hedge funds doing in terms of dealing with the underperformance? Because there was a decent amount of underperformance. I think I was telling you before, I was talking to Charlie McElligott about this, and he was saying that if you look at the March lows, there was a lot of volatility there. And the vol from that 3 months ago is falling off in terms of the value at risk models that people use in order to decide how much leverage they have. So here we are in June, July, all that's in the past. So we have volatility numbers going lower in your VAR model, telling you you can leverage up. And therefore, to a degree that you underperformed in the market, you can actually get in on the bullish side and, you know, with leverage into those positions. So what are you seeing in actual fact in terms of what hedge funds are doing? Are they chasing returns in that same way?
Yeah, I think they have to. They have a high fee structure, right? Like the 2-in-20 model is like getting completely annihilated. Like you're lucky unless you're Stevie Cohen at 0.72, but and a couple other funds. But people are trying to raise capital at like 1-in-10 now in hedge funds. Right. And that's basically a function of endowments and pensions basically saying, you know what, we're not going to pay up anymore for mediocre performance. We're going to go to private equity. But one of the interesting things that's happening as well, you mentioned, you know, levering up, is you watch the bond market rally. Like I think the 10 years at what, 60 bips and 30 years at, you know, 130, I believe, like pretty much super lows. One of the interesting things Mike Green said also is to give him props is like owning treasuries is essentially you're owning a put that you're getting paid for.
Right.
When you're a risk arb guy and like you just lever up against all that collateral, right? So all these bonds that have rallied, now they have more firepower to go to war with, right? And so you seek the highest return. So you can actually make the argument that with rates the way they are, the market's acting pretty rational where it's going to the highest growing stocks, right? And the ones that are super levered, which is, you know, you have a lot of debt on your balance sheet, generally those are the older companies. Underneath the really fast growing stocks, you have these, you know, the market's down, I think, 13% if you take away the fangs. And those are generally ridden with debt. You know, the really fast growing stocks are capitalized with equity and they have lots of cash on their balance sheet. You know, the market makes sense in a lot of ways from that perspective. And I think, you know, Lacey Hunt says debt is a tax on future earnings or income, right? So what you're seeing is a real discrepancy between really fast growing things and then legacy older things, which is like, you know, ETFs and old active managers that charge high fees, right? Why the heck would you pay? It's just a better product. You know, why would you pay an active manager in this setting to underperform if you can outperform with, you know, less price?
Right. I mean, and you're outperforming for a longer period of time. I mean, supposedly the reason that you pay is because that outperformance doesn't last, you know, 8 years, 10 years, the way that it has been lasting. And so therefore you make up for it on the downtrend. But you know, we're not seeing, I mean, we had a 35% loss in March, but then the market rallied up and we're up like, you know, 45% from the lows.
It's crazy land. But then at the same time, like what you're seeing is, you know, these pensions, look at CalPERS. They're now saying, you know, we're going to use some leverage here.
Right. That's my next question. Right.
And they're looking for returns. So like, how are you bearish on risk assets, like for super fast growth things, when one of the biggest pension funds in the world just said at any dislocation, we're going to basically use leverage.
Right.
It's really hard to do, even though I completely agree with all the bears economically, where it's just a complete disconnect. And one of the most fascinating things, though, I think you're seeing is you might stifle volatility superficially in the market, but I think you're seeing what Chris Cole calls is like you transmute the low volatility into social upheaval. And I think that's a lot of the stuff you're seeing politically right now, is, you know, all these things are vol dampeners in the market, but the majority of people are kind of left behind, which is causing, like, basically inequality. All these things are kind of breaking: globalization, inequality at massive, you know, levels. And I think we're just not, we haven't seen the blow off top just yet and all that stuff.
Right. You know, that is the how can you put it? That is the elephant in the room in terms of how this works, because, you know, what I'm having go through my mind as you're talking about that is the concept that, let's just say that we have a W type recovery. Okay. So we had, we went down, we did a V-shape up, and then we start to roll over towards another sort of downtrend. What happens if all of the liquidity that you talked about makes the disconnect continue, even in a situation where, we start to roll over for the second time? That's even more of a disconnect between the real economy and the financial economy. Is that something that could even happen? How does it manifest itself in terms of that social unrest?
I think you start seeing people, you know, picketing for Jeff Bezos to get taxed at higher rates. You know, you're seeing tax structures already kind of popping up in the election. I think that'll be a strong talking point for these guys. Because, and probably one Biden will really hold on to. So that's where I see it coming most. You know, the other interesting thing that's happening, I'm calling this all like generational arbitrage.
Mm-hmm. Right.
People get the heck out of the coasts, which are generally millennials leaving really high priced real estate and going to places like Austin, Texas, where I am now. Or Nashville or Denver. And it really is like this generational change. And you have two people from the gerontocracy running for president, basically trying to hold on to the legacy systems. And I think the reason why you can't really be bearish is because they're going to do everything in their power to pull out all the tools in financial chicanery to keep this thing going.
Right.
In a lot of senses, like if you look at the venture capital markets, they barely had a hiccup. Like they are funding companies left and right now, you know, and I think that will keep this thing going as long as there's some promise of future growth there somewhere and the funding doesn't get pulled from the endowments or pension funds.
Right. And, you know, you were talking about the gerontocracy. Immediately I go back to PIMCO, or not PIMCO, CalPERS, and the retirement crisis, right? Because we actually worked in the retirement crisis series that we posted up on RV, I guess it was like 7-8 months ago now. What are your thoughts about the retirement crisis in the midst of what we're talking about now? That's sort of a secular trend. Is it something that it's been arrested for now, or is that breathing down our neck underneath, despite the fact that, you know, because CalPERS, that's what they're doing, right? They're trying to stop that from becoming a problem.
Yeah, I that's really the engine of it all, is you have this, you know, basically baby boomers have a lifestyle that they want to keep up, and they want kind of millennials and Gen Zers to pay for it, right? They own all the assets. As long as they keep bonds at yields, low yields, then they don't have to do any work anymore. And they don't have to cut their pensions. They can do all the political promises. I think you're going to see maybe that just keeps going and pensions get funded with printed money at some point, and then inflation becomes a problem. And we are seeing that. One of the most interesting things in the market, Teddy Vallee had a great chart on this today, which is, 5-year real yields are super negative. And that mimics like basically momentum stocks perfectly, and gold stocks as well. So those I think are just in secular bull markets. Like they're not going to let deflation happen, because if that happens, they have to answer to, you know, unfunded pensions, lifestyle, they're just going to print, you know, gazillion dollars. And I think that's the spot we're at right now, where it's, this might be a raging bull market in the face of an economy that's never been worse. Like UBI could be a real thing. Like Andrew Yang could be right, where just like, you know, maybe that's the debt jubilee that everyone talks about, is you just hand out money.
Right. You know, scary prospect. And, you know, I'm going to leave it on that note. I think let's have everyone savor more from Tyler Neville. It's, you know, it's been a, I think it's been a sobering and almost scary initial foray into the Real Vision Daily Briefing. Tyler, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, though.
Thanks, Ed. I hope I pissed off all your subscribers. Take care, man.
You too.